Hello, everyone. Welcome to this session. My name is Louise Morse. I'm the Division Chair of STR, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to this Scholar Practitioner Seminar on Public Policy Contributions of Strategic Management. This session is hosted by the Membership Engagement Committee of STR and organized and hosted by Tigra and Charlton from the MOTU Economic and Public Policy Research. So thank you very much to TIG for organizing this session. We're running several events at STR on impact and relevance, hence my background. So keep an eye out for our upcoming events. So I'm not gonna hold up the session anymore. I'm gonna hand over to TIG to introduce today's events and our two speakers. Thank you very much to David and Annabelle for being here today.
Thank you very much, Louise. Okay, welcome to this STR panel discussion on the public policy contributions of strategic management, bringing together two of our division's most influential scholars for a wide-ranging conversation, David J. Teese and Annabelle Gower. In terms of structure, the session will begin with remarks from David, followed by opportunities for audience Q&A. Then on the hour, Annabelle will share her reflections on this subject, followed by further Q&A. From a housekeeping perspective, there are just a couple of things to highlight. It would be great if you could keep your microphone muted unless you're asking a question. And if you're comfortable having your camera on, it would be great to see as many faces as possible. The session will be recorded and we hope to share afterwards via the STR YouTube channel. And lastly, please do use the chat function at any time to add questions or comments. And also in the chat, I've linked to both panelists' full biographies. With all that said, let's move swiftly on to hearing from David. It's not an exaggeration to say that I could spend the full hour introducing David and talking about his accomplishments. Professor David J. Teese is a professor of the Graduate School and the Thomas W. Tuscher Professor in Global Business at the University of California, Berkeley. His work has significantly shaped the landscape of strategic management, theory of the firm, the economics of technological change, technology transfer, antitrust economics, and innovation. David's work has been cited more than 200,000 times on Google Scholar. He's authored more than 30 books and 200 scholarly papers, and is, of course, particularly well known for pioneering the dynamic capabilities perspective, which has been hugely influential in our field. David co-founded the Berkeley Research Group, which has over 40 offices and 1,200 employees. He holds a PhD in economics from the University of Pennsylvania and has been awarded 9 honorary doctorates and recognized with royal honors. Additionally, and of particular interest to us today, David's work on antitrust policy and intellectual property have informed and influenced public policy decisions worldwide. His work has spanned industries from music recording and semiconductors to software and energy. David has testified in both federal and state court, before Congress and before the Federal Trade Commission, as well as in several international jurisdictions. It's a real privilege to have David with us today, and I think we're all looking forward to hearing what he has to say on the topic of the public policy contributions of strategic management. So thank you very much, David, and the floor is yours. I will pass over to you now.
Well, thank you very much. And as most of you know, my first degree is in economics, and I've sort of drifted off into management and business, which I consider closely related to economics. I've actually in my career worked simultaneously, you know, as a scholar and being very active, you know, in public policy and litigation, et cetera, et cetera. And let me say that I really think there's an opportunity for people in strategic management to contribute more, because there's a set of ideas in strategic management which are relevant, particularly for antitrust, but also for intellectual property, but particularly for antitrust, which are not understood by the competition agencies and by most of the economists. You know, simple things, you know, like business models, for instance, believe it or not, you know, simple as a business model is, it's only now just getting or finding a place in antitrust. But there are much more important questions around why firms have market power in antitrust. And of course, In the field of strategic management, we've been focused on competitive advantage from day one. In the old days, strategic management, a la Michael Porter, there was no gap between economics and management, because what Porter did was essentially take industrial economics as it was in the 1970s and just rewrite it from the perspective of management rather than the policymakers. So whereas the field of industrial organization was trying to understand monopolies and how monopolies came into existence, Michael Porter said, well, if this is interesting, if we know something about the control of monopolies and how they come into existence, maybe from a management point of view, we can figure out how to build, we called it competitive advantage, but some amount of market power, which is, how we think about successful enterprises. So as we've drifted away from sort of, I'll call it Porter-esque IO, and embraced, I'll call it a resources/capabilities view, there is a whole new perspective on the business enterprise that can help us understand, one, outcomes in the marketplace, and also the role of government in regulation or in antitrust enforcement. And I'll just use one example in the limited amount of time we have. In the DuPont merger in Europe, the question before the court was, will this merger harm innovation and competition from innovation? Now, I think our field of strategic management has taken innovation a lot more seriously than economics has. Economics has got, stuck in the sort of the Arrow Schumpeter debate about whether monopolies assist or stand in the way of innovation. Whereas the field of strategic management, I think, understands that innovation is not a linear process. I think we understand that that resources and dynamic capabilities, or capabilities more generally, are an important part of innovation. So in assessing mergers, actually in the DuPont case in the EU, the agencies actually started to look at what they called future competition, or potential competition, as we might think about it. And I think the field of strategic management has a lot to say about how firms are positioned, not necessarily in product markets, but in terms of their resources and capabilities, and how that affects outcomes. So there is right now an open door for folks in the field of strategic management to walk in and inform, I'll just use this one example, a merger analysis, for instance. When's a merger going to be good for society? When is it likely to result in reduced competition? And the whole concept of, quote, nascent competitors, which economists are starting to talk about. I think, the field of entrepreneurship has a lot more to say about nascent competition than the field of economics does. So I want to sort of just begin by saying there is a opening wedge, or there's an open door now to walk in, but it's an open door that requires you to come in with a deep understanding, though, of how competition law works or intellectual property law works. So it's not an easy road for people in our field, but for those that are willing to make that investment, I think there's the opportunity to do some quite interesting things.
Thank you very much, David, for those remarks. I will, in the minute, turn to Q&A from the audience. So by all means, please use the chat function if you've anything you'd like to ask David, and I'll call on you to speak. David, before we turn to audience Q&A, do you mind if I ask you about your experience I suppose, building bridges between strategic management and the competition economics perspective. So that AMP article from last year, for people who are interested in maybe pursuing this direction, it's a very, very helpful read. But in table one of that article, you lay out sort of the competing viewpoints of the different perspectives. When you're standing in a room in front of a policy audience, many of whom who are probably coming from an economics background, how do you go about building bridges and establishing legitimacy is probably the wrong word, but buy into strategic management research, if you like?
Very good question. The challenge is not as difficult as you think, for two reasons. One, you're not often talking to economists, you're talking to an agency person who may or may not be an economist, or you're talking to politicians. Quite frankly, the vocabulary and the ideas in strategic management ring a lot more authentic than a lot of the economic models do. So one, we have an advantage there. Two, there are many agencies that are coming around to the view that sort of standard neoclassical economics is not enough. So there is opportunities, and you know, Annabelle, I know, has walked into some of those, as have I. There are opportunities to actually put out fresh perspectives that have, you know, maybe a few more variables in it than what the economists use. The economists generally, if there's not a model that establishes something, you know, they feel very insecure. You know, I put way less weight on having a formal model. You know, a formal model just can be confirmation of some ideas we have, or maybe it provides new insight, but it's not critical. So economists sort of shut themselves off from ideas that are new and uncomfortable. But not all of them do, and there's a growing recognition that ideas from the field of strategic management may be relevant. So I think you have to understand not only what the field of strategic management has to contribute, but you have to understand where the other folks are coming from and the intellectual background and the intellectual apparatus they have. It's only then that you'll see the gaps. And that's the big investment you have to make. Otherwise, it's going to be ships passing in the night. You know, I have the advantage that I started in economics, and in fact, I still consider myself an economist. And yet, you know, I'm, you know, well, reasonably well read and in the field of strategic management. And I think both fields have something to say. If you folks can, you know, double down and get some understanding of where the sort of neoclassical frameworks are all at, then I think it'll be easier to have conversations. And what I'm saying is there's an openness to those conversations. It's not been there for 30 years.
Thank you very, very much, David. That was very, very helpful. I might call on Crystal, who has a really interesting question in the chat. Crystal, if you would like to unmute yourself and ask your question.
Oh, great. Thank you. I'm following with great interest. I am in the marketing discipline, but I read your work and I find a lot of inspiration from your work. And my question is about whether the division of our universities into schools, some universities have econ as a separate from the business school, departments within schools, reduce our ability to innovate our theorizing, our ideas, and also, given today's topic, the ability to think about policy applications and implications. I would call this a type of balkanization. And if you think that's the case, what might we do about it?
Well, first of all, I'm very much in the intellectual mindset of Sir Herbert Simon and the Carnegie School back in the 50s and 60s, which saw contributions from all fields of organizations coming together with economics. So that's where my mindset is. And you're quite right. You know, we in the university, we have compartmentalized things. So my view is, look, if you're an untenured professor, you kind of have to play by the rules of the game and stick to your narrow little, you know, swim lane. But once you've got tenure, you know, you've got the opportunity to, and maybe even not just the opportunity, but the mandate and the social responsibility to actually go and address problems as they are rather than as we would like them to be. And I've always followed the problem and, you know, and being respectful of what economics has to contribute, what psychology, marketing, and every field. I got that from the Carnegie School and Oliver Williamson and Ed Mansfield, who are my mentors, and Richard Nelson, who's still alive today. These people were at Carnegie in the 50s for that brief period of less than a decade. We had the greatest sort of outflow and outpouring of social sciences innovation, and we haven't seen anything since. So, you got to be interdisciplinary, and that requires communities to support each other, because you're going to get cut down for interdisciplinary work. You got to please nobody in the academic world some of the time, but you will please the policymakers, because when you're interdisciplinary, you'll find you've got an outside audience. So those that are multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary, they will have a much easier job talking to people in government and policymakers. They'll have a much easier job. So that's where you get to shine. So there's a payoff there, but you kind of have to do two things at once. You know, you have to satisfy, you know, your mainstream departmental requirements and do what's important. You know, there's a little piece that in the Wisconsin is Business Review or something or other, I wrote on this, how to be a practicing intellectual, and you've got to kind of live two lives, and it's hard work, but it's rewarding if you're able to do it.
Thank you very much, David. I remember a similar set of remarks you made at the SMS keynote in Paris a few years ago, and it really stuck with me. It was very helpful. Ms. Lav, I might call on you. You have a really interesting question around the role of theory in strategic management and how that affects our ability to contribute to policy. Would you like to unmute?
Yeah. Thanks, Nat, for that. So this is coming from me, who has like a strategic management position in a public policy group. So I'm always struggling with these things quite a lot. So one of the things that I've seen that in different disciplines, even in branches of econ, or like public economics, et cetera, policy evaluation is like a commonly accepted research design and approach, right? Oh, let's try and assess the policies and evaluate policy in different ways. Well, in management, this is not as accepted. Every time I'm trying, because I'm a lot of my research, I'm trying to do that, I have to almost kind of mask it into some broader theoretical discussion or puzzle around something, right? On the one hand, we are kind of pushed to assess changes that are really impactful now. For instance, let's say going back 2 years back, how did COVID subsidies that we're giving to all these firms, how did that influence performance and behavior of firms? If you put it really that way, it seems more like a policy question. And then unless you really carve out some kind of theoretical puzzle, it seems hard to communicate and manage. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I'd like to hear David's kind of perspective on this. Is this changing, or is it just something that you have to do?
Well, look, I'll answer it in an oblique way. I think our comparative advantage is understanding the business firm and competition, and we have a much broader way of thinking about business. This is where you can contribute the most, because economists are running around with sort of a production function view of the firm. That's all they got. There's no room for capabilities, no place for innovation. You know, the field of strategic management is really an eclectic field. There's no, you know, there's a bunch of dominant ideas, but nothing super, super dominant. And we just got insights into things that are beyond what neoclassical economics could provide. I think our advantage in policy is to take those insights, which are rooted in theory and evidence, and bring them to bear on policy questions. It'll be the COVID-related, be it antitrust, be it intellectual property. Everywhere, you know, we're dealing with the regulation of business and the impact of business on things. So we should not, you know, vacate policy, and you know, the economists have managed to get in there and sort of become the kings and queens of analysis of policy issues. But I think everybody would benefit, including the economists, if there was a richer understanding of the business enterprise and resource allocation inside the business enterprise and so forth. I mean, the economists have gotten into network effects and scale effects and two-sided markets and all of this. That part they've done quite well. But, you know, the role of culture, the role of capabilities, the word capabilities does not exist. You take, you know, maybe an economic history book, textbook will have capabilities, but you look at industrial economics and you look in the index for capabilities, you'll find a big fat zero. So, but the very essence of the business firm is that it's got capabilities, both ordinary, super ordinary, and dynamic, that enable it to get things done. How is it, how can you possibly shape policy without an understanding of that? So that's the place, I think, that we have a comparative advantage and can deploy knowledge and understanding, and at least put an alternative perspective out there and encourage debate.
There's a that was.
Can I just clarify something, Pat? Sorry, and then just a second. Yeah, my question. Thanks a lot, Dave. My question was more about the other way around, not doubting how much we can contribute to policy, but it's more about how do we as a field and people who are editors of strategic management journals and chairs of departments, how they see of evaluating policy as a contribution to strategic management rather than the other way around. So that was more, how much is that accepted in strategic management journals and these different outlets? And do you see if that's a space?
Well, maybe there's a new journal that's needed to do that. And maybe you'll set it up. But you're right, it doesn't fit easily in right now.
David, I'm conscious of time, so I might sort of paraphrase two questions into one and maybe build on a point that you've made previously, and that's around the distinctive contribution of strategic management, especially as in a dynamic and changing landscape. And you spoke there to advocating for capabilities and innovation and their role. I suppose my question would be maybe if we looked at something like AI and regulating AI, some of your earlier work around R&D cooperation and around competition has advocated for the innovation outcomes and the role of innovation and emphasizing that perspective in regulatory decisions. I'm wondering, do you see things in a similar vein when it comes to AI, and what could strategic management researchers add to the policy discussion around AI?
Well, I think the answer is there's a lot. I mean, first of all, understanding the trajectory of the evolution of AI and what capabilities matter and who's got them and how they're likely to evolve, you know, that's something that I think we have a better shot at doing. Around any, you know, economic historians used to be good at doing that. There aren't any of those left, or business historians. There's almost none of them left. But that's, you know, the evolutionary perspective, which you get from Nelson and Winter and so forth, I think is relevant. You know, understanding how policies will, you know, how they'll be seen on the other side of the fence by management and what management's likely reaction to policies is, not in terms of what they say, but in terms of what they do. I think that's where strategic management can come into play. I mean, look, economists have this sort of incentives. That's all they look at all day long, is we want to understand how it impacts incentives. And I agree, incentives are very important. But there's more than incentives, you know, when you're looking at regulations, more than how it affects incentives. It's, you know, how it affects structure, how it affects behavior, how it affects culture. There's a whole bunch of other variables that can be analyzed. And I think increasing the richness of the set of issues and methodologies for exploring is where we can help.
Thank you very much for that, David. I know you have another commitment on the hour. We may not have time to get to Andre's hand. My apologies for that. I just like to express a huge thanks before you go, for your remarks today, which I think have been quite thought provoking, but also, I suppose, more generally, for your contributions, which many of us have built on over the past few decades. So thank you very much for joining us today, David. I appreciate time was tight.
Well, thank you very much for organizing this and giving me the opportunity to talk to you, because I really have a passion for this and would like to see the field be more impactful, not just on management, but on policy as well.
Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
Annabelle, thanks for setting this up too.
Great to see you, David.
So I was really thrilled when our second panelist, Professor Annabelle Gower, agreed to be part of our conversation. I think many of us have learned a lot from her work recently, from her 2019 book with David Yoffe and Michael Cusimano, The Business of Platforms. Professor Gower is a chaired professor in digital economy at the University of Surrey Business School in the UK, where she also serves as the director for the Centre of Digital Economy. Annabelle is a thought leader on digital platforms and platform-based innovation ecosystems. She's written more than 40 articles and 4 influential books, which have shaped scholarly, managerial, and policy thinking on these topics. Annabelle regularly consults for the major international corporations on platform and ecosystem strategies. Annabelle holds a PhD from the Sloan School at MIT. She was named Fellow of the British Academy in 2023 and Clarivate Highly Cited Researcher in Economics and Business in 2022 and 2023. Annabelle was the co-chair of the first AOM specialized conference on big data and managing in a digital economy in April 2018. Annabelle has advised the European Commission on the regulation of online platforms as an expert member of the European Commission's Observatory of the Online Platform Economy. She's also advised the UK Parliament House of Lords, the UK government, and the OECD. Annabelle, I'll give you the floor for some opening reflections, and thank you very much for being with us today.
Dad, thank you very much. And Louise, thank you as well. It's a great privilege to be here and to share some of my experience about engaging with policy. I would like to say that I think that engaging with policy is extremely important, because as management scholars, we both have some knowledge. We know about the research. Our research is rigorous. We know about the literature. We care about business when we care about society. And we are, so therefore we are a legitimate voice, and we are neutral. We don't represent private interests. We may have opinions, but I think that comes with the work of a scholar, a part of integrity that make us people who speak about issues where usually the debate is crowded by lobbyists. And these are very contested debates. So I will just share a little bit about my trajectory and my experience and how I came to engage with policy. I don't have a background in policy at all. I started my studies in science and in engineering. I worked in engineering for a few years, and then I did a master's at Stanford in industrial engineering. That was before I worked as an engineer. And then I did my PhD at MIT, as you mentioned, Tad, in the Management of Technology and Innovation group, working with Rebecca Henderson and Mike Cusimano, who was my advisor, my main advisor, and Scott Stern. The fact that I came to do graduate studies after having worked in a corporation for a few years, as opposed to having gone directly from undergraduate to a PhD, I think gave me a particular perspective on the importance of academic work and the type of academic research that I was interested in, which was very close to the phenomenon. I very much appreciated what David T. said about the Carnegie School, about being close to the phenomenon. MIT also had a tradition of being very close to the phenomenon and not sacrificing rigor or theory,
but my approach has never been to do research for theory's sake. And I do understand the importance, and I have myself contributed to theoretical development, but I think of theory as a lens that is only helpful if it helps us understand reality better than our previous theories and or bad theories. And so I've been close to the phenomenon of platforms and ecosystems for, I would say, over 25 years now. And my career and my research and my engagement with companies and later with regulators and policymakers has been a result of this very deep engagement with the phenomenon, combined with a curiosity, an intellectual curiosity about learning different theories and trying to contribute to different theories, like different facets to a complicated phenomenon. So if you think about the phenomenon of, you know, digital platforms and platform-based competition, which force you to have both an understanding of the economics and the organization and to some extent of the technology. You cannot approach such a phenomenon if you are in a siloed way, looking at one particular literature. Especially when I started, there was not even a literature called a platform literature. Some people are very kind to credit me as well as other colleagues to have, you know, helped to build that community. But I very much agree with what David said earlier about speaking two languages. You know, when you are trying to approach a problem, and if you want to have an impact on policy, which was your question originally, Tad, before coming from a perspective of saying, I want to have an impact on policy, one has to have a curiosity and a genuine interest for problems that affect society. These problems do not fit neatly into our literature review gap. Right? And so we have to be able to both operate in a world where we converse and build upon existing theory, as well as investing quite a lot of time in understanding very richly and deeply a phenomenon, so that what can really earn a position of legitimacy to be considered an expert and to be listened to and to have the responsibility of saying things that are not wrong and perhaps correct on these topics. I was inspired as a younger scholar by a paper by Stefano Bruzzoni and Andrea Principe and Keith Pavitt that looked at firms and said firms know more than they make, and they make more than they sell. And I think as scholars who want to have an impact, we need to know more than what we write. And that means that, to build on an idea that my professor Jim Marsh had at Stanford, we need to have some slack in the system. We need to maintain, and it can be extremely difficult, that curiosity and that extra energy after we finish doing our R&Rs, and after we finish doing our teaching, and after we've, you know, tried to be responsible for the people in our lives that we care for, be they children or spouses or friends or aging parents. We need to have that extra energy if we want to have such an impact, which, you know, we don't have to for our career progression. But if that's an appetite or a thirst, I think we need to find more energy to become curious about the debates of the day, to understand what is the nature of these debates, and then to lucidly and with a bit of humility try to ask ourselves, do we really have something to contribute? What I have found is that if we have something could contribute, it comes out of a frustration that the tenor of the debate seems to be missing something important that perhaps seems very obvious to us. That can be a trigger. That's not enough. That little impulse is not enough, because then there is a work of, as David was saying, understanding the languages of the different audiences that you want to engage with. Before saying, I want to have an impact, we have to be able to listen and understand what, say, antitrust lawyers are saying, or what, you know, policymakers are saying, or what parliamentarians are saying. We have to read these reports. We have to agree to spend time accepting to engage and sometimes educate the policymakers and the regulators. None of that is being paid. none of them is being rewarded immediately with an article or, you know, with consulting money. So there is quite a lot of investment there. But I think that if one has a feeling that one could possibly contribute to this, and one finds it, you know, gratifying for its own sake. I know that I have learned a lot by engaging with policymakers and regulators, as well as firms. I engage a lot with firms. This is where I learn. So I think of it as, if you wish, an investment in terms of, this is how I learn. I don't just learn by reading AMJ and AMP and SMJ and ASQ, you know? And I'm sure many of us don't just get ideas from there, you know? So think of that, think of all these other sources which force us to speak different languages, to hear different languages as sources of ideas, as sources of ideas in terms of these are the problems to be solved, these are the debates that are happening, and perhaps we can bring a perspective that's helpful, that's actionable, and then I think it can be quite natural. Tactically, I would say if you're interested in engaging with policy, start attending a few policy conferences, write perhaps opinion pieces or books, or books can be a double-edged sword in our profession. And even if I committed a few in my early part of my career, I certainly would not recommend that to anyone. I didn't realize what a strategic mistake it was. Because people just think that, oh, well, if you write books, you're obviously the type of person who write books, which means obviously, you know, you cannot write a journal articles, you know. So it there is a bit of a sort of a labeling and identity that you have to it takes a while to convince people. You know, you said very kindly, Tad, that I wrote 40 articles, which is very true. But I wrote them, you know, perhaps not in the first 2 or 3 years of my career. And there are still some people who haven't sort of followed what I've done, who still think of me, oh, yeah, Annabelle, she writes books, yeah, right? Yeah, yeah, which sort of, yeah, well, you know, it's not that serious, right? So managing your image as well, you know, both towards the different audiences in terms of legitimacy is important. But I think we have a lot to contribute. I agree with David Teese that there is a door opening. I may be a bit less optimistic than him in terms of just how wide that door is at the moment. There is, among policy circles, a bit of a disillusion about pure economics, pure IO, let's put it this way, in terms of antitrust in particular. There was a very interesting article published, I think, yesterday by a former Nobel Prize in economics called... I forgot his name now. Mr. Deakin, yeah, who explained that, you know, the economists have, you know, missed the financial crisis. They have justified a lot of behavior by companies that equate to basically legitimizing, you know, plunder. They were over optimistic about the effects of globalization. They were not realizing the effect on workers and on poverty and on inequality. And so I think policymakers, which used to look at economists as having the answers to everything, today there is a combination of factors also in the digital economy with platforms and digital markets and the monopolization and the concentration of these markets, the fact that many markets have never been as concentrated as they are, and we have this very useful you know, concept in strategy, the difference between value creation and value capture. You know, as I've written in a couple of articles, in the digital connected economy, we have a very fragmented and diversified modality of value creation because we all create data. But never in history has value capture been so concentrated. So we have a paradox of digital platforms and ecosystems where those who create and those who capture are not the same. And so we see an appetite from policymakers and regulators to understand these digital markets, to understand what can be done about it. And I think as strategic management scholars, we can have a voice of reason, which is neither at the complete extreme, you know, or let just the market sort it out, it's going to be fine, we don't have to intervene at all, or the other extreme, which is, you know, big business is evil, or even business is evil, and let's break them up and let's go back to the commune, you know. So we do understand the trade-offs, and therefore I think there are opportunities for those who have that appetite to engage, to learn, and then to have something to say.
Thank you very much, Annabelle. That point about speaking two languages is very interesting. Maybe we might get a chance to come back and flesh that out. But Louise, I might call on you. I'd really be keen to hear your question developed a little bit.
Thank you so much, Annabelle, for being here and for sharing all your experiences. I think this is really valuable. So many members of the STR community are young scholars, PhD students, and early career professors. So I was writing in the chat, based on your experiences, what advice would you give to all these young scholars who also would like to have an impact on policy, but at the same time, they have to manage their careers. And as you mentioned, maybe publishing books is difficult for them early in their careers. So they're focusing on publishing papers at the same time.
Right. So let me be... let me try to be honest here. And by honest, I mean recognizing the cost on someone's career in the early years to invest a lot of time, because it does take a lot of time to do something else than just try to get tenure and try to publish articles. I think that it's quite risky to try to spend too much time in policy circles if you are not tenure yet. And also, I just saw fleetingly a comment in the chat, which I think is very well taken, which is policymakers are not particularly keen to hear from assistant professors. They are quite sensitive to the labels. You know, full professor, in their view, is a more serious voice than an associate professor, which in their view is a more serious voice than an assistant professor. And we can moan about it, but I think pragmatically that's the case. So I would not necessarily suggest to not do any policy work, but think of those years as a way to make connections in those milieus, learn about the issues, perhaps develop some ideas, as opposed to do a lot of very time-consuming work. I also think that before having something to say, you need to know a lot about it. And so it takes years to develop expertise. And I just want to share a little slide, if that's okay with you, just to show you a bit when in my career, so to speak, I started to engage with regulators. So let me try this. Yeah. Yeah, so, and if you see that. Right, so I started with writing this book, which was more about the phenomenon of platforms. And then a lot of my career was a back and forth between the theoretical contribution, which are in the yellow box on top in several literatures, platform competition, innovation, and governance. And then so these were more empirical work, and then the conceptual clarification. So there was, you know, a fruitful back and forth between the empirical studies, various literatures, economics, organization, strategy, and the clarification of the concept. And it's only later on, you know, that I've begun to engage with regulators. I'm not suggesting that that's the yellow box, you know, when issues around governance and issues of power and regulation and self-regulation, you know, that was a natural, if you wish, output of where the phenomenon was going and where my interest was going and where the regulators and policymakers needed some expertise. I'm not suggesting this is the only way, you know, but I think for those of us who start I guess it depends the topic you're working on. In the beginning, I was not working on topics at the time that in my mind had anything to do with policy. But I guess within strategic management, there are areas which are a lot closer and related to policy. For example, I think people who work on corporate social responsibility or sustainability. I think there is quite a natural, you know, link to the current debate. I also think we are in a different period in time than the world was 30 years ago. Today, there is a lot more contestation about the established system, about unfairness, and therefore public policy questions are part of a natural debate. So perhaps, there, and I'm sure there will be other ways for a younger generation to engage.
Thank you very much, Annabel, for those pragmatic points. I might call on Jas. You touched on the point about ECRs, but I think, Jas, your question about methods is an interesting one, if you would like to unmute.
Yes, thank you so much. Thank you so much, Annabel. This is a really pertinent discussion. So as you've said, you've already answered the question about ECRs. My question was around, obviously, the previous methods of economists being very secondary data, quantitative based. How do you see qualitative work developing in these sensitive areas where, you know, things like antitrust or platforms or technology strategy, these organizations close up the moment you start asking for more qualitative data? How do you see a qualitative researcher progressing in this field? Thank you.
So I'm not sure I heard right your question slash comment. I thought when you began to speak that you were talking about to which extent do policymakers have an appetite or find it legitimate to use research that is based on qualitative methodology. And then at the end of your comment, I thought you said something about publishing within the field. Now, how hard or how easy or how legitimate is it? Or how hard is it to get access to companies, I guess, to get data about qualitative? So I'm not sure. Were you speaking about both or just one and as imagine the other?
Yeah, the question was more on the second side, but actually the first one is very relevant as well, that, you know, how do they value a qualitative work? So, but also, and how does a qualitative researcher progress in terms of getting data and then publishing from it? So both, actually, right. If you could.
So
thank you.
Because this session is really around, you know, the impact of scholars on policy, let me start with the first point. Policymakers like numbers. Many policymakers will have to justify whatever decision they're going to make on numbers. And even if our qualitative methods are rigorous and have become more rigorous with time, I don't think the perception of rigor is strong enough in many policy circles to just take as is some results coming from qualitative work. Luckily, when a question is important, you tend to have in the literature a variety of researchers and a variety of methods addressing a particular problem. So just because your work may be qualitative doesn't necessarily mean that you cannot also find other work that you agree with or that you think is worthwhile that you can bring to the attention of the policymaker, because you know so much more than they do about the various research around a particular topic. So I think as of today, there still is a negative perception of qualitative work versus quantitative work, which is a crying shame, because a lot of qualitative work can be extremely advanced, you know, just to build again on David Teese's remark on models. You know, so, you know, we can have models, we can have quantitative, you know, econometrics type analysis, we can have, you know, also, you know, network-based analysis, and then we can have all varieties of qualitative work. All of them are very valid. Some of them are more useful to do exploratory work. Some of them are more useful to do more deductive work and, you know, to prove, you know, some hypothesis, where the previous qualitative work might be better suited to generate novel hypotheses. So, be aware that with just a purely qualitative approach, you might not get policymakers, you know, saying that, ah, great, that's the research we've been waiting for. You know, you're going to have to try to find ways to buttress that argument, probably bringing in some quantitative work, which may or may not be yours.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Annabel. I think Adesina, I might come to you. You have an interesting question, and I think this speaks a little bit to the extent to which we can or can't expect policymakers to read what we would write in academic journals. So I think that might be maybe a launch point. Do you want to unmute yourself and ask your question? We're not quite. Adesina?
Sorry, yeah. Yeah, I just unmuted myself. So first of all, I'd like to thank, Professor Gawa for making the time to speak with us. I've spent some time reading her articles, and I'm a postgraduate researcher. I'm actually studying for a DPA as opposed to a PhD. But I have spent quite a bit of time in industry, and, I identify a lot with what she said. My question really is, and I'm really pleased that I've got the opportunity to ask this of Annabel, because my favorite papers that she's written, was one that was published in Research Policy, which had to do with platforms and explaining it about economies of scope and economies of scale, etc. So my question is, how do policymakers react to researchers or professors who got the credibility of publishing in top journals such as Research Policy? So it's gone through the rigor, it's been well cited, and it's probably on a topic that may be relevant to what they do. So how is that perceived?
So, okay, let me again try to be very candid and very direct. Policymakers that I have met do not read academic journals of management. Just whether they are ASQ or AMJ or Research Policy, not only do they not read them, they don't even know the title of these journals. They're irrelevant. They are not in their world. So we should not expect policymakers to either read them or to be impressed by the fact we've written. Now, what they read are other things, briefs, policy briefs. What they read are policy reports, right? So perhaps you might want to find an opportunity to write a report for a policymakers or for an agency, where it might be the same ideas that you have developed in one paper. Usually when you are asked or invited to write a report, it's not on the basis of one paper. It may be on the basis of multiple papers, and that you have reached a position of being known as an expert. So it will be a combination of you've written, your articles in academic journals. You will also have had some pieces perhaps in the media, or you have had been interviewed in the media with some citations. You might have appeared on some television program or YouTube program. So there will be a constellation of outputs, which together are going to form an impression for policymakers that you know what you're talking about, right? But it is not the case that just because you have written an article or two or three or four or five in very well regarded, policy or management journals or academic journals, that alone is going to make, I think, an effect on policy.
Thank you very much, Annabel. I think that's really helpful to keep in our minds. We might take one more audience question. Andre, I'll come to you if you wish to unmute.
Thank you, Dad. Pleasure to be here and hear this lecture. Hello, Annabel. Nice to see you.
So
my question is related to both what Chis said and you said as well. This question comes from, let's say, the context of Brazil, where sometimes, and I think this can be seen in other places as well, besides thinking about policymaking, is to think about policy effectiveness, right? Here in Brazil, for instance, we have several institutions and policies that are designed to boost innovation. Every you know, every policy that you can imagine, all kinds of incentives that you can imagine, you can find here. But at the same time, there seems to be a mismatch between, you know, policy intentions and the expected outcomes. When policy simply do not induce the type of reaction that you are expecting to have. So I think this is a, you know, a gap of research, and we'll have some moments to discuss here in Brazil at the event, the Balas 2024, and you know, how to get not only the attention of policymakers, but also to think about policy in specific context, given the fact that you cannot actually have one policy that will solve all problems, right? So they have to be context specific. So this is a gap. I think it's more like a question and a comment as well. So we'd like to hear your thoughts on this. Thank you.
Yeah, Andre, thank you. And looking forward to attend and to be the keynote speaker at the Brazil conference, Balas, whose theme is on innovation ecosystems. That's fantastic. I mean, your question about measuring the effectiveness of policies is super important. I think that some areas of policy are better than others at measuring impact of existing policies. And I don't have much to add to the fact that I agree with you that it's important. I don't know enough to know how well it's done in some areas and in others. I know that with regard to health policy, at least in the UK, there seems to be a fairly robust way to do postmortems or to look back at the effect of policy on the population. And I think part of the challenge about measuring the effectiveness of policy has to do with the political process within which policies get created. You know, there's going to be some pressure on some politicians, maybe civil society or some other ways, and then some new laws and regulation is going to get voted in. That is going to be part of their political platform, if you wish. And then by the time the effect or the impact of those policies could really be measured, usually these politicians are gone. And not usually, you know, a high priority for the next generation of politicians to do very rigorous measurements of the impact of the policy. They have easy to understand messages about we have to keep doing the same thing, or it was a catastrophe, therefore you have to vote for me because I'm different. And so perhaps the lack of continuity which is a good thing, the fact that we don't always have the same politician, you know, that's a democratic process, but maybe one of the reasons why it's insufficient and there is insufficient effort in that. But that could be a very powerful contribution to strategic management, you know, measuring the performance. We know a few things about measuring performance at the project level, at the firm level. Mm-hmm. You know, so we may as a community be able to provide actionable insights. First of all, motivating the importance of measuring policy and then measuring how to measure the effectiveness and perhaps suggestion as to how to find resources to do so. I think that's a very important topic. You know, I don't have more to say about it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Annabelle. And I suppose just as a closing comment from me, I would maybe point people towards, there's a video on YouTube, Annabelle, of you testifying as an expert witness to the UK House of Lords. And just for people who are maybe thinking about how to articulate evidence to a policy audience, or the level at which findings should be pitched, that is just that opening section of remarks is just an incredibly articulate and clear and explicit summary of quite a complex literature, and certainly maybe not as well understood at that time 7-8 years ago as it is now. So just as somebody who wants to explore this further and see a very practical exemplar, I would point people towards that video. All that remains at this stage, we've run past our allotted hour, is to say a huge thank you to everybody for being here, and especially To David and Annabelle, who have been extremely generous, and Frank as well, in sharing their experience and expertise. Thank you also to the SDR division for their support, and to Louise Moores, our division chair, who is here with us today. That's all from us this afternoon or evening or morning, depending on wherever you are in the world. Thank you all very much for joining us, and hopefully we'll see you at some of the other STR virtual events that are coming up on this impact and relevant topic. So thank you, Annabelle.
Thank you, everyone.